The things we all carry is a podcast about first responders and their stories surrounding trauma on the job. The intention of this podcast is to raise awareness and share meaningful conversation around a subject often viewed as taboo or simply ignored. Be aware this content may be graphic and it is real. It may not be suitable for children or adults triggered by this subject matter.
Welcome back to The Things We All Carry. As I normally do, I'm sitting down with really no idea what I'm going to talk about in this intro. Today's been one of those days. It's one of those days at the end of one of those weeks again. And I went back to therapy for the first time today in a long time. And I just felt it was a good time to kind of check in again, maybe a tune up. But once I left there, I kind of discovered that I need more than a tune up. I need to do that on a more regular basis. And I need to be realistic in the fact that sometimes I need that space to talk about whatever's on my head and whatever's in my brain, whatever's in my heart, whatever it is. And I went in there today thinking I really didn't have anything to say. And of course that's complete bullshit because there's a ton to talk about. And I've known Lisa for a couple of years now, and she's heard some of the, as any therapist, if you're honest with yourself, she's heard some of the deep, dark things in my head or my soul, and nothing outrageous, but you know, mistakes I've made and things I love to atone for and things I've experienced that I just haven't shared with many people. And there's a few select people that know some of that stuff and really, you know, as it should be, your therapist needs to know about it. And I walked into her office today and it's one of those spaces that it's inviting and it can be warm, but it's also a memory of, man, I've had some, tumultuous times there and dropped a lot of tears there. And I kind of thought to myself, well, that's not happening today. And surprise, it did. Of course I cried. I talked about a few things that I really didn't realize had been affecting me the way they were affecting me. And for those of you who haven't been to therapy, it's the best, worst thing you can do. And what I mean by that is it is cathartic. It is helpful. It is refreshing in a way, but it's also exhausting. It wears you out. It's a 12 round title fight, you know, to take a stance from boxing or whatever championship fight for the UFC. It will leave you bruised and battered inside. And even on those innocuous times where you don't think you're going to come out feeling tired, you still do because you still find something to talk about. I talked a lot about leaving the job and I dealt some emotion out in that room today because some of it I felt like I needed a space to talk about it, talk about maybe some disappointment of what I found upon leaving. And I don't know why I would be immune to it, why I'd be special or I would be different, but it's true that the door slammed shut behind you in a way. And I guess I've kind of felt it a little bit and it's fair. I get it. You step away and everything goes on. It continues on without you. And that's to be expected. That's the way it's supposed to be. That's the machine. You're just a cog and that cog will get replaced. But it still hits you a little bit. It still smarts a little bit when it happens to you. So you'll pardon me if today is a little muted on my end. I'm still kind of recovering and I tried to go to the gym, tried to shake it off a little bit. Got a little leg workout in, got a sauna time in. And then I realized I had to get booking because I had spent my time traveling to and in therapy and then traveling back and then the gym and I need to get the show done to get it out. And it's tough to do these intros when your head's just not there. So here I am in front of a mic, just wondering. So maybe the best thing to do is to kind of just talk about the episode that's coming up and introduce you to the guest and get out of the way and let his story be told. Welcome to episode 109 of The Things We All Carry. Today I have Zach on the show. Zach is out of Ohio, and it's a small farming community he lives. It's called Van Wert, Ohio. Zach is a husband and a father, and he has been a career firefighter since 2015. And he's also a veteran of the United States Air Force. And his stories kind of intertwined between personal life, Air Force, and firefighting. He's had some experiences in all those areas that really kind of shape who he is and where he's going to go. He faced a court-martial in the Air Force. And for anybody who's not familiar with the military, that means that he had some charges pressed against him and he had to fight to clear his name. And he did. He cleared his name, but it took a battle and it took a toll on him. You know, at the same time, he's still working as a career firefighter and experiencing traumas on the job that strike him close to the heart just because of the situations that he's been in and the family that he has. I'm happy to say that Zach was with us to record this show, because at one point he had decided that he wanted to end his life, and he was interrupted in the process of kind of following through on that, and happy to say he was interrupted. And he discusses that. He discusses how he was interrupted and where he went from there and how he's started to recover after, you know, thinking about suicide, a long legal battle, and some traumas on the job, and losing a friend to suicide. This one is one of those stories, like I said, is intertwined. Everything is interconnected, and you have to listen to all of the pieces to get the big picture, and he kind of lays it out that way, you know, kind of lays it out. While this is going on, he's still doing this, and while that's happening, he has this going on. And it's one of those where it was multifaceted, and thankfully he's on the road to recovery and he's doing well. And that's fantastic. It is the best we can all hope for. So you guys sit back, listen to Zach's story. Hopefully you enjoy it. You get something from it. Again, please don't hesitate to reach out, get in contact with me, give me some comments. Let me know what you think. And I'm always open to having conversations with people. You guys get outside and start to enjoy this spring that's coming our way. Get out there and do something for yourself.
If you're comfortable, right, we can just kind of get this conversation started and see where we end up. And I will probably screw a few things up, and it's not a big deal, because I'll edit whatever we screw up, or whatever I screw up. Let's put it that way.
Good.
All right. Well, welcome back to The Things We All Carry. This morning, I have Zach with me. Zach is joining me from Ohio, and you said Van Wert, Ohio, correct, Zach?
Correct.
Give me an idea of where Van Wert is.
Best way to describe it, people from familiar with the area, we're right between Lima, Ohio and Fort Wayne, Indiana.
Okay.
US 30.
All right.
About an hour and a half from Columbus, an hour from Toledo. We're just small farm community based right on a highway.
All right. And you and I talked, I don't know, how long has it been? A couple of weeks now?
Yeah, probably 2 or 3 weeks.
You have been a career firefighter since 2015. You were also in the Air Force. You had joined the Air Force in 2010, and then you got out December of 23, correct?
That's correct.
And I don't want to go too much into that transcript, because I think we're going to give some stuff away that I think I just want you to discuss. I know that when we first talked, you talked about leaving the military, focused on rebuilding your life, and then your experience with the Employee Assistance Program, EAP, and which I want to get into a little bit, because not many people have a good experience with EAP. So if we get into that a little bit and talk about what you found. And then kind of, like you said, acknowledging a counselor who understands those specific experiences and traumas that we go through as first responders. Tell us a little bit about your life right now.
Are you married? You have kids? What's the deal there?
Yeah, so I'm married. Married my high school sweetheart in 2015. We've been together since 2008. We have two kids, both boys, 4 and 6, and home life. We lead a very active life, try and travel as much as we can. We're outdoors. My kids absolutely love playing outdoors. We do same vacation every year. We go northern Wisconsin, do a big fishing trip with the whole family. And then professional life, the 2nd of this month, 2nd of February, I got promoted to lieutenant at work. So I'm now a lieutenant on shift with a captain and 4 other firefighters. And I'm main role is inspection and fire prevention. So I'm in charge of going out to schools and educating kids and the public on fire prevention.
So what was the last song you heard?
Oh, what was the last song I heard? Actually, I can just pull it up on my playlist.
I was going to say, you can cheat.
In the car on the way home? Yeah. Oh, yeah, I'm cheating. The last song I heard was, what's it called? Coulter Wall, Sleeping on the Blacktop.
Oh, it's a beautiful song. I love it. Yeah, that song is awesome. Coulter Wall's got one hell of a voice, and he's an interesting person with the fact that he'll put music on hold to be a ranch hand.
Right.
Yeah, he turned down Rogan because he was on his ranch. You know, who does something like that?
Rogan out there.
Yeah, right. So that just tells me all I need to know about someone like Coulter Wall. You know, if you're okay, this is what's important to me, and I don't care that you're the biggest name in podcasting. I'm going to do what I have to do for me, and that's wonderful.
Right.
All right. Tell me, you grew up in Ohio. Grew up in the town you're in right now.
Yeah. I moved. Used to live north of where I'm at. I moved to this area about 4 or 5 years old. And I've been here ever since. I live right outside. It's called the Village of Wren. Like 180, 190 people. So small community. We know everybody. And yeah, I've lived here my whole life. I live 1.5 miles from my parents, 2 miles from my sister. So we're just all like a really close family here.
So how was childhood? I mean, you said it. You live 1.5 miles from your sister, from your parents, and so I'm assuming they're together still, and that was a stable family, stable upbringing.
So my mom actually divorced my biological dad when I was young.
Okay.
And then remarried when I was about 4 or 5, and my now father adopted me shortly after that, and yeah. Stable home. Dad's a truck driver. Mom works in transportation industry. And, you know, we'd all just all found houses close to home, and great having that support.
I was going to say that's an experience not a lot of people can claim they have. And that's a wonderful thing.
Yeah. I mean, we're daily communication. Between Snapchat groups with our whole family and text messages, you know, I mean, my family, we communicate daily. So
growing up,
really nice to have that.
It's a small town. It's a small town. It's a farm community, correct?
Yep.
And so what drives you towards the Air Force? Cause you joined the Air Force in 2010. How old were you in 2010? And what made you pick the Air Force, and why did you decide to leave town that way?
So, my great uncle, was a pilot in the Air Force. He was a B-29 pilot in World War II. And just growing up, I spent a lot of time with my grandfather on my mom's side and listened to him tell the stories and everything like that. From a young age, I wanted to join the military, but you know, I never knew what branch I wanted to join. Didn't know what I wanted to do. I joined between my junior and senior year of high school, and a friend of mine was a volunteer firefighter in our local community, and he went to a fire one day in December, right around 2009, 2010, and just listening and tell the story about it and how exhilarating it was, is like, you know what? Well, I can do that. And did some research, found out that the Air Force has the best fire protection program in the military. Started talking to recruiters and got on with my local volunteer fire department right around that same time as a junior firefighter, and wound up getting a contract in the Air Force Reserve as a firefighter at Grissom Air Force Base, and you know, just pursued that.
So did you get a chance to do any adventures, quote unquote, when you were in the Air Force? Did you deploy anywhere? Did you?
Oh yeah.
All right. Where'd you,
yeah, so
what'd you do?
As a reservist, you know, we do obviously our 2 weeks a year. So we travel stateside quite a bit. Deployment wise, my first deployment was a humanitarian mission to Miami, Florida, when Hurricane Irma struck. We were a standby quick reaction force for that. Got a phone call at 3 a.m. right when the hurricane made landfall and said, pack your bags, we leave at 8. So woke up, got packed, and we were boots on the ground within 12 hours. And then in 2019, I deployed to Kuwait. I was stationed at Ali Al Salim Air Base. And then part of my task at that time was to help build a new installation at the Kuwaiti International Airport. And I was a liaison with the Kuwaiti firefighters. So I'd have daily meetings with them, or I'm sorry, weekly meetings with them, trying to set up mutual aid agreements. You know, for us, resources were limited where we were at. We had one engine, one crash truck, and a tanker. So if we had any problems with planes or anything, we would need the Kuwaiti firefighters. So worked a lot with them. And then 2020, 2021, I deployed for a Homeland Security mission out of Savannah, Georgia. The fighters that kind of protect the capital region were based out of the airport there. So me and a couple other firefighters went and acted as liaisons, since we're Air Force firefighters, to interact with the fighter aircraft that would be flying the Capitol.
And I know that the Air Force wasn't all positive for you. You had some struggles and you had to you had to beat a charge that you were falsely accused of, correct?
Correct. Yeah, it wasn't all rainbows and sunshine. I'll preface it with anybody listening who's kind of on the fence about joining. The military is great. It's great to serve your country, but there's also some things. Like, I was hurt on my 2020, 2021 deployment. I tore my shoulder. I still have yet to be reimbursed for that. They haven't paid the surgery. I lost 700 hours of sick time through my fire department trying to recover from that. And I have yet to be paid either the surgery bill or compensated for my time from the military. And then mid late 2021, I received notification that I was a subject of a sexual assault investigation. An allegation back in 2016 that apparently had just surfaced. I won't go into a lot of details, just confidentiality reasons. But it was a 2-year process, almost 3 years dealing with Air Force OSI and the legal process. And that's probably one of the darkest points of my life. And then also with military service, you know, I lost my best friend in my unit to suicide in 2014. So it wasn't all positive.
So how long does it take to clear your name once the accusations come?
It varies so much. You know, I've heard of basically the accusation happening and it stopping right away, within a week. And then mine, you know, I was one of the unlucky ones where it went full court press. So I went to a general court martial, spent a whole year preparing for that and dealing with my legal team, which, you know, I wish I could give them a shout out. It was probably the best people I've ever seen in the military. Compassionate, caring. Like they saw my innocence right away and they fought tooth and nail to prove it. And I owe everything to them. And my leadership as well. My leadership throughout the whole thing was fantastic. did everything they could to keep it from going as far as it did. But unfortunately, there's rules in place. The military doesn't have the best reputation when it comes to sexual assault. So, you know, they treat it very seriously, and I understand that. But, you know, when there's absolutely zero evidence to drag a master sergeant through the mud like they did, it hurt, and it hurt bad.
Yeah, I guess I was going to ask that. It's such a weird thing because you joined the Air Force looking for, technically looking for experience, looking for adventure, looking for crew or that team feeling, and then you end up having to defend your name against baseless accusations. Well, I say baseless because obviously your legal team and everybody saw the fact that you were innocent. And so how do you recover from that yourself, I guess is my question.
When I fully get there, I'll let you know.
Okay.
So that trial happened the first week of December. And I know it's really close to the time I ended my military service, but you know, for all the listeners, I was completely acquitted of all charges. It was probably the worst week of my life. I lost 10 pounds during that week. I just couldn't eat, crying uncontrollably, panic attacks from hell. Like I've been in high stress situations before, but I mean, that was probably by far the worst week of my life. And I'm still on the road to recovery, man.
Yeah. And it's a weird thing that accusation. And when it's a false accusation, it's such a tough, well, first of all, it's a tough thing to beat, as you obviously experienced, but it's also this stigma that, yeah, that you have to defeat at the same time, because not everyone sees the evidence.
My biggest fear. Yeah. I mean, my biggest fear as I started to let people in, because, you know, we're in the firefighter world, we are masters at hiding what's going on, you know, masters at masking our feelings. My wife knew about everything right away, and that's it. You know, my crew didn't have an idea. A few friends from the military that were also questioned about the incident, because they were in the same general area, knew about it. But other than that, you know, I mean, my mom, my parents didn't even know until a week before the trial. My mom is awarded as a true victim of sexual assault. And I struggled with talking to my mom about it because of that stigma. You know, what's my mom going to think of me? You know, yeah. I know I'm her son and she's going to take my side, but my mom being a victim, you know, is she going to think less of me because I have this charge against me? And, you know, they don't take it lightly. I was looking at 30 years confinement and sex offender registration for life.
Yeah.
So I told my mom, she was rather disappointed in me. My mom is a very well-connected person, and her first concern was, how good is my legal team? You know, we have a week before the war starts. You know, I want to talk to your lawyer. I want to talk to him now. So I called my attorney, and she was very professional. She spoke with my mom, ran her through everything. And my mom hung up the phone with her and said, I don't know how you got that lucky. Because my legal team was, for being what we would consider in the outside world as a public defender, because it was an appointed attorney. I mean, my senior attorney and my assistant attorney were top notch. I mean, they were just amazing. They left no stone unturned throughout that entire process.
Yeah. And like you said, you get through this trial and it taps you out. It really does. It exhausts you mentally, physically. I mean, physically, you just said you lost 10 pounds in a week, and it's something that hung over your head for quite a while. But that's not it. You also mentioned that losing the friend while you were in the Air Force. And if I'm not mistaken, and I apologize if I am, I believe it was around the 2014 timeframe.
Yeah, it was June of 2014. I'm sorry, July of 2014. You know, we had just had our drill weekend like a week before, interacted with them. You know, we were talking the day before because his sister was due to get married in October. And, you know, you're shooting the shit over text message. At the time, I was working at a private ambulance company. I was a night shifter. And I saw his Facebook post probably 9:30, 10 o'clock at night. And I remember clear as day, we were sitting down to watch a movie because we didn't have any calls pending. And I saw his Facebook post that just said, you know, I'm sorry, everybody. I just can't do this anymore. I love you all and please forgive me. And I chalked it up to, you know, maybe he's drunk, just having a bad night. And I didn't reach out. I didn't call. And I got a phone call about a half hour later telling me that he was gone. And I still have yet to fully recover from that. I'm still close with his family to this day. His sister is like a sister to me. His parents are like parents to me. And through the whole process with the legal trial, I don't know if we want to jump to that part already, but, you know, I got pretty dark and there was a point where I was going to take my own life.
I think that's an interesting thing about your story a little bit is that you have this parallel of your Air Force time and you have your issues that you deal with, which are major issues, suicide of a friend and the trial. Those are two major issues that you can make an episode of this show alone based on. But at the same time, you're working private ambulance, you're into the fire department and you're adding traumas in that world as well. And so there's this dual timeline that we talk about because you have the suicide of your friend, but then you also have the professional challenges while you're working as a firefighter.
Mm-hmm.
And so share a little bit about that move from not just Air Force Reserve, but in private ambulance, but moving down to the fire department. Let's kind of see if we can dance a little bit with a dual timeline a little.
Absolutely. Like I said, I joined the Vanmore Fire Department in 2015. You know, it was kind of slow to start, not a lot of calls. I was just a basic EMT. Late 2016 into 2017, I was fortunate enough, my department paid for me to go to medic school. And, you know, my wife was pregnant same time I was in medic school. She had our son, our first son, Theodore, about a week or two before I passed the national registry test. And, you know, passed the test, became a medic, new dad all at the same time. You know, life's perfect. I mean, there's nothing that can take me down. And then I was on maternity leave with my wife and I was out jogging one morning. And like I said, I volunteer as well. And I'm coming down the road and my neighbor, who's also on the fire department, sees me, stops, tells me to get in. You know, what's going on? He said, we got a call. It's cardiac arrest. Okay. Jump in with him, get the notes when we get to the station and find out that, you know, this is a 2-week-old infant. And this child was 3 days younger than my, or 3 days older than my son. We get there. The child's lifeless in the crib. We have a big Amish community here. It was an Amish household. You know, the child's lifeless in the crib. We chalked it up with SIDS and stayed on scene, let the coroner do their thing, and we went back in service. A week later, I go back to work, and you know, my first call back on the truck is, you know, another pediatric death. A father had beat his 2-month-old to death, and we responded to the scene. Get him in our truck and I see right away as the paramedic in charge, I'm at the airway. And as I'm trying to intubate him, I see a bruise on the side of his face, just in covering his eye socket, cheek, everything. And I instantly, the father was on scene and met us at the hospital trying to say it was SIDS. He put him down for a nap, came in, found him unresponsive. But you know, I see this mark on his face. And you know, as you say, my spidey sense tingled and knew we have an abuse. And then I just stacked on, had another one, 2-year-old was a little while later, 2-year-old was had a trach, and his trach got dislodged, and he went into respiratory arrest. Thank God we got him back. We did get the abused child back too. We worked him for probably an hour in the hospital with the ER staff, got him back, and he succumbed to his injuries 2 days later at Children's Hospital. Had a 2-year-old drowning. He was playing hide and seek with his nephew or his cousin, hid in a hot tub. And, you know, I go to church with this family. He hid in the hot tub, lid came down on him. I don't know if it knocked him out or what, but they found him lifeless in the hot tub. And, you know, we worked him as long and hard as we could, but there was nothing bringing him back. Short time after that, a 16-year-old wrapped her car around a tree, just got her driver's license a week before. Hit so hard that her face was completely deformed. She was in the driver's seat still, but shoved into the back seat. And then, about 4 or 5 days before I found out about the investigation, we had a 13-year-old who him and his friend went car hopping and found a gun, and they took it home and they were messing around with it. And he unfortunately wound up discharging the firearm while it's pointed at his head. That, aside from the pediatric calls, that was probably the worst call I've been on, because even though the age difference is there, I saw my friend. The only thing I could see the entire time I'm working this day is my friend's face. And that one seemed like an eternity. Total call time was about 11 minutes from arrival to arrival at the hospital. But
yeah, you know, you go through that, and I've heard this, it's almost a phenomena that you people talk about. Well, I had this many of this specific call type in a row. And you're not necessarily getting them in a row, but you've got a ton of pediatric death that just piled up upon you.
I think the total was 7 or 8 in 6 months after my son was born.
That's outrageous. You know, that's for most people, that's unheard of.
Yeah. I want to give a shout out to my fire chief, though. You know, there's a lot of departments that don't get the support. The drowning happened on a Sunday afternoon. And by the time I got back to the station, my fire chief was in the building and immediately pulled me into his office. You know, he's seeing all these trends. He's seeing that, you know, I'm just getting pounded with pediatric calls. You know, and I made a joke during medic school, you know, young and eager. I was like, I hope to God I never get pediatric calls. Absolutely not. I don't want to do it. And, you know, we'll say I'm a quasi expert in it, but the trial by fire, I got pretty good at it there at the end.
That's the worst jinx anybody could put on themselves.
My chief sat me down. He pulled me off the medic for about an hour, and we just sat in his office and talked. And his main concern was, are you okay? You know, do you need to go home? He listened. He let me stay at work. You know, probably like most of the listeners, my comfortable place is at work. I can separate my emotions and just be ready for the next call.
So I give him credit, because he recognized what was going on, and he pulls you aside and he wants to just touch base with you and see, make sure you don't need to go home. And that's a great approach to it. Is there anything else offered to you at that point?
Mm-hmm. He spoke with me about the employee assistance. I hadn't used it with the city, mm-hmm. but I did utilize it when I worked private EMS, and, you know, I turned off to that right away. When I worked private EMS, we had a gang shooting and we were mandated to go by the hospital we worked for. And, you know, I sat in this room, just like you see on the TV shows. He sat in his chair with his clipboard and I sat on a couch or a recliner or whatever it was. And I spoke, he kept looking at his clipboard, nodded his head. Yep. That's terrible. Oh man. Can't believe you had to see that. He had no fucking idea what it's like to see that, what you know, watching a kid who 18-year-old involved with a gang get shot up and die in senseless violence. He's never experienced it. You know, he's just going off what his textbook tells him I should be feeling. And that's basically the diagnosis he gave me. He said, everything's normal. Your feelings, your thoughts, they're all normal. I see no need for you to continue unless you absolutely want to. And I just, absolutely not. I went back to work and, you know, I didn't start going to therapy again until January of this year.
Yeah. And that's all right. So the 13-year-old, the suicide where he shot himself is in, it just, I had to imagine it floods back the memories about your friend. And it's at that same time frame, basically, that you hear from the Air Force that this whole investigation is going on. And so that starts 2 years of a fight that you're not just
hell. Yeah.
Yeah. You're not just battling your demons from the fire department. Now you're fighting for your life. And go ahead.
My counselor now puts it, you know, my backpack was full.
Yeah.
And that final rock that they threw at that investigation was the point where my backpack failed and everything. I could no longer control my emotions. I couldn't control my thoughts. I just, instead of being able to go numb and ignore everything, I was having panic attacks weekly, isolating myself from people, my family, my wife and kids. I became a workaholic just to keep my mind busy. Doing work in the hospital, the paramedic, and you know, I was picking up every hour they had. I was doing 110 hours a week. I'd work a night shift hospital, go work a 24 at fire department, take 12 hours off sleep, do it all over again.
Yeah, completely unsustainable.
Yeah. And yeah, that lasted about a month and a half, and I finally saw what it was doing. It was ruining the marriage, ruining my relationship with my kids, my coworkers, and I finally resigned from the hospital. I couldn't do it anymore.
And when you say that it came to a culmination where you, your backpack was full, and we all have the different analogies, a bucket, a backpack, a file or whatever it is. When you came to that point. Yeah, file cabinet. When you came to that point, you said that it's a snap, basically, correct?
Yep. It was a point that I never thought I would get to.
So why don't you?
I would always,
yeah, why don't you?
Especially after our friend.
Oh. I got to apologize because we have a delay on I think at least on my end, and it's causing me to step on your toes a little bit, and I apologize.
You're good.
All I was going to say was, why don't we set the stage a little bit? And I think that's what you had started doing. So I will get out of your way and shut up, basically.
All right. No, you're good. Yeah. So I finally learned that, you know, this investigation isn't going away, because it went about 8 months where I didn't hear a word. You know, I didn't have a legal team yet because my understanding was it's not going anywhere. And I finally got called by my first sergeant and was told that, you know, shit's getting real and you need to get an attorney. He gave me the contact info, and that was it. My backpack failed. I was at my sister-in-law's. My wife and I drove separate. And I made up some excuse to go home, and my wife was still there with my kids, and I came home. Had no idea what was going to happen on my way home. You know, I'm just a blubbering mess, so to put it. I'm, you know, trying to formulate my thoughts of what the hell is going on. Where's my life going to be next year? What am I going to do? And I got home and I went upstairs to my bedroom where my backpack was, and I pulled a notepad out. And then I sat on my bed with the notepad in my lap and my pistol off my nightstand just sitting next to me. And I tried to figure out what to write. Figure out how to put it into words to my wife, my family, my friends, but yeah, most importantly, my kids, of why their dad just gave up. Why their dad promised that, you know, I would never let anything bad happen to them. And why I promised my friends, if they are ever hurting, that they need to call me. I don't give a shit where they are in this world. Being the unit we're in, I got friends as far away as Milwaukee and Green Bay. And you know, I told them, you know, you need help, you call me. I'll come drive there. I'll sit. I'll get a plane ticket. I'll come sit with you. I don't care what it costs. I'll be there. But I didn't reach out. And I tried to think of what to write. And I finally got to the point of, you know, fuck it. There's nothing I can put into words. My wife knows what's going on. You know, she'll understand. And I picked up that gun and made sure it was loaded. I stared at it for a little bit. And by the time I lifted it to my head, my Ring camera went off, which is weird in of itself. I'm the kind of guy, my phone volume is never on. My sound's always off, so I don't forget it at work. But I must have turned it on that day waiting for a phone call, and it went off. And the first voice I hear coming inside is my oldest son, who was about 4 and a half at the time. And I hear him yelling my name, and he runs upstairs. And I, of course, have the gun hidden by this point. And he sees me crying, and he asks me what's wrong. And I just, you know, told him dad's sad. And he gave me a hug and all excitedly started telling me about everything he did with his cousins. And it was about 2-3 months later, I told my wife about what happened. It was, while telling my wife what happened, I realized that I could have pulled that trigger. Sorry. I would have pulled that trigger. My son would have found me laying in my bedroom in a pool of blood. I would have destroyed that child. Could have destroyed his trust, his future. And that destroyed me.
Bon, I think I just...
Still hear me?
Yeah, I can still hear you. Sorry, I muted things because of this chair, but now we got the echo.
No, you're good. My headphones just died, but yeah, that was the absolute darkest day of my life. The amount of peace I felt when I finally put my hand on that gun, and just working in a hospital as a medic, I had to sit with psych patients a lot. And some of them talk, some of them don't. A few of the older people I've talked to that were experiencing crisis, you know, they said the same thing. You know, I got so peaceful when I made that decision. You know, when I finally said it's time, my stress, my anxiety, my fear, it just all left. And if my wife would have left a couple minutes later, I would hope I would have been strong enough to hold out, but no sack. My son will never know the gift you gave me that day. And he will never understand what he gave me back that day.
I don't know if that's a conversation you plan to have with him.
So believe it or not, I've actually talked about that a lot in therapy. Because that's the biggest thing I struggle with is forgiving myself of how far I got, kind of unchecked. And I don't know, maybe someday, but yeah, that's definitely an adult conversation we'll have when he's old enough to understand everything. Or not have, I don't know yet.
Yeah, that's a tough one. And that's such a, obviously such a personal decision. And
you know, it's almost in a way. Yeah. He walked in at just the right time to save you from doing what you had made your mind up about, but it's almost like, yeah. I don't know. It almost, does it create a sense of guilt for you if you do tell him, because you have to admit to the way things are or were?
That's where I struggle with the most with it. I want to be honest and forthcoming with my kids no matter what. And I teach them the big value I try to instill in them is, you know, no matter what's going on, we can work through it. Just be honest. You know, if you're honest, my guarantee to them is that they're honest to tell the truth with me, I will not get mad at them. You know, I may be disappointed, but if they tell the truth with me, I will not be mad. Maybe a little upset and disappointed, but that's it.
You know, we had this conversation. Yeah, we had this conversation at work yesterday with a coworker of mine, and he and I were talking about when do you have adult conversations with your children? At what age are they able to handle such, you know, adult topics? And I don't necessarily mean, you know, the thoughts of suicide, but just in general. As adults and as parents, we go through life and we're kind of put on a pedestal by kids for years. You know, it's like we're their beacon basically, and things fall apart. Mm-hmm. And how much do you share with your kids when things fall apart? And he, I guess he and I had a very similar view, you know, at the onset, but then he's like, well, at some point you have to tell him. And I don't necessarily agree with that. I think at some point you have to guide them, but I don't think they need to know the ins and outs of every decision between you and your wife, that your wife makes, that you make. These are very adult decisions. And until they're ready to process that, they definitely don't need to hear it.
Right.
I don't know. It's a delicate balance.
Right. And so my kids, obviously with me being the military, they know I traveled a lot. Mm-hmm. And there was always that fear when I would pack a bag. You know, they knew, especially my oldest, you know, he is so smart and clever. He knew something was wrong. And obviously he didn't know. He asked me why I had to leave. I said, you know, I got to go fight bad people. And of course, being six, he's like, oh, like you're going to war? I said, no, you know, Dad's going to fight bad people with his word.
Mm.
And the night before I had to go down for the trial was a terrible night. You know, my oldest son is just crying in bed, doesn't want me to leave. I told him I'll be back Friday, even not knowing if I'm going to get through this, if it's going to be a favorable outcome or not. But I guaranteed him I would see him Friday. We had a plan that our friends that were watching him would start heading down Friday morning and just be in the area. That way I can at least see them. And he was still inconsolable. And that set me over the edge. I went into just a complete anxiety attack breakdown. You know, I'm crying on the floor in my bedroom next to my dresser, and my wife is doing everything she can to get me out of it. And it's not working. And my son, we had our door closed and our door opens and we don't see him, but he crawled into our room and laid next to our bed where we couldn't see him and was just crying. So I picked him up and we just sat on the floor and cried together for probably 20, 30 minutes. And we both got calmed down. You know, my son was the only thing that brought me out of that episode I was in. And, you know, I get in bed with him and my wife woke me up about an hour later to come to bed. And, I know I say the worst time, but with my kids interacting and knowing something's wrong, that was, as a father, that was terrible.
Yeah, because we have this overblown, in a way, view of what we're supposed to be as parents. And if you have a break in that. And reality is we're all going to have breaks in that because we're human beings. But when you have a break in that, you feel like you've disappointed everybody.
Hey guys, quick break right here just to check in and thank each of you for listening to the show. Your support has been paramount and I appreciate all of you. I have one request though. I need you to share the show with everyone you know. Help me get the word out and spread these stories as far and as wide as we can. While you're at it, please leave a review of the show wherever you happen to listen. Feel free to reach out to me at any time to share your story, to talk, or to pass on suggestions. Let's get on with the rest of the show.
When all you really did was show that you're human.
My biggest fear through the whole thing was losing Bull and Post with. And as irrational as it was, I mean, once I started queuing people in, one of the things I was able to do was get support letters as far as my character. And as I started asking people, I mean, I asked probably 30 or 40 people and there wasn't one person that said no. And my mailbox just flooded with letters and I was able to read some of them, you know, just what people think of me. You know, I never saw that in myself. I never saw myself that way. You know, we're our own worst enemy. And look, I told my mom, we were talking about it recently because she was in contact with my legal team the whole week. She talked about the side, figuring out with work, she goes to court a lot. So she knows the questions asked and everything. And they basically told her that, I think it was Tuesday or Wednesday, that, you know, this is going to go in his favor. We have no doubt. And she held that from me because she didn't want me to, she told me she held it from me. She didn't want me to get overconfident, I guess. And I snapped back with her and said, Mom, the Lord himself could have came down and said, it's not going to go bad. You're going to be fine. And I wouldn't have believed him. Not until I heard the jury read that verdict.
Yeah, that's a great point that don't want to tell you because you don't want to get confident and you don't want to lose focus on just fighting. So all of this is going on. You've got, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, you're good.
I was just saying all this is going on. You've got some emotional battles on multiple levels. You've got the calls that piled up at work. You've got your friend's suicide. You've got the court case. You have it all culminates in this moment where you sit on your bed and you say, this is it. I can't do it anymore. And luckily it's interrupted. And now you have to figure out, well, what the fuck am I going to do? Right. So what happens that next day or the next couple of days in this process?
It was a mental whirlwind. So there was a potential deal where I would just get discharged from the military under other than honorable conditions and we don't go to trial. And, you know, I'm not one to quit, especially knowing everything that happened.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not one to back down, but I looked at it also as, you know, I got to think of my kids. I got to think of my wife. You know, this is without a doubt the fight of a lifetime. And, you know, do I risk everything for the potential to lose it all? And I, right away, after speaking with my wife and coming to the realization of what I almost did to my son, it was, I'm going to fight. You know, fuck this person that's making this allegation against me. Fuck the military for making me feel the way I feel. You know, I'm going to go to court and I'm going to destroy them. And that lasted up until probably a month before trial where I'm ready to fight. And as trial got closer, you know, I started weighing decisions again. You know, if I lose this fight, you know, again, we're looking at a maximum of 30 years. Now, would I have gotten that? I don't know. I don't know what it would have looked like. But the biggest thing for me, I can, you know, jail time, I could probably survive. What I couldn't survive is being labeled a sex offender. I can no longer go to my kid's school. can no longer go to their sporting events. Both my kids, they play baseball, they wrestle. They want to start soccer. You know, I can't do school functions anymore. I can't even go to church because my kids go, we're a Catholic. My kids' school is attached to the church. Mm-hmm. It would have just destroyed everything. It would take my career from me, passion from me. So I tried to put the deal out there and see if the accuser would accept it. And there was back and forth of whether or not they were going to. And then, you know, last minute, it was rejected. Everybody in the whole chain process thought it was a deal. If I would have taken that deal, the only thing that would have happened to me is, you know, I'm kicked out of the military and I can never join again. I lose my veterans benefits, which, you know, sucks. I have a pretty good disability claim with the surgeries I've had, but yeah, I can live without that. I don't currently collect them. I can live without that. But then when the deal was rejected, it's like, you know what? It's game time. That was my final exit ramp on this highway and it was rejected. So, you know, we're going to go to court and we're going to let the justice system figure this out.
How long did the trial take?
In total, the first 2 days were jury selection. Being military, I was allowed to have jury members that were enlisted. We didn't have enough enlisted after the one-year jury selection on Monday. So it got delayed until Tuesday afternoon. We finalized jury on Tuesday and trial kicked off on Wednesday. Wednesday was the prosecution's turn to present their case. And just like we anticipated, they made me out to be an absolute monster. Like, I had this planned. I knew what I was doing and everything. And then Thursday was my team's turn. And my senior defense counsel, who was very experienced and probably as passionate as you and I about the fire service as he is with his career in law. Like, this dude, I joked around and called him Rain Man of the courtroom because he knew what he was doing. He's a grand wizard at chess. Like, he had everything set up and he told me, you know, our defense rests a lot on you testifying. I can't tell you how it's going to go if you don't testify. So would you be willing to testify in your defense? You know, I had every right to just sit there, but, you know, I decided to take the stand and the direct examination went great. My team was awesome. And then the most terrifying thing for it was the cross examination.
Yeah, I can imagine. And
it was, it sounds silly, but one of the things I had learned, speaking with the base mental health person who was basically told to do weekly check-ins on me leading up to this. And she's great. She's, I think she's a psychologist. Got her master's in psychology. I know that, but she, is a former cop. And so she knew us really well. And that's what got me into the pursuit of a therapist who knows us. But she taught me the whole grounding technique. And my wife, we actually had Legos in my truck for my kids because, you know, they like to leave toys everywhere. And the whole time I kept myself calm. I just held on to that Lego piece. And it was like one of those eight square blocks or eight rectangle blocks. And I just counted the pieces. I counted the little knobs on it the whole time. And that kept me calm. And I was able to analyze his questions and he wasn't able to trap me. So that helped a lot.
So you're found not guilty. You're cleared of charges.
Yep.
And yep. How long between the time you're cleared of charges and you get that off your shoulders, do you decide it's time to leave the Air Force?
So my contract was supposed to be done in September of last year, but with everything going on, they did a 90-day forced extension, which put me to Christmas Eve. last year. Initially, I wasn't sure what I was going to do. As my wife said, you know, don't react in emotion.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we got the not guilty verdict. We spent some time to ourselves right after that. And then my kids showed up and I made the decision right then that I'm not re-enlisting. We had a long, 2-3 hour conversation about it a couple of days later of, you know, do I re-enlist or not? I'm a firefighter by trade. So in the military, I was an operations chief, and the people of that fire department are family to me. I mean, there's 4 or 5 of them that we interact every day. Our kids know each other. Our wives all interact, and you know, they're brothers to me. And the thought of walking away from them was the biggest hurdle, but speaking with my wife and speaking with them, they all understood. And I made the decision the day before my contract ended that, you know, I'm just going to separate. I don't know to this day, I don't know if it's permanent. You know, I only have 7 years left to make it a career. So I may take a year off, work on myself and re-enlist, or I may, you know, enjoy civilian life and out of that headache, just spend time with my kids. You know, it's taken a lot away from me. I missed the birth of my second child being deployed. I miss my oldest child. I missed all of his even birthdays up until his sixth birthday. His sixth birthday is the only even birthday I've made it to. So I think I'm probably just going to enjoy civilian life and work on my disability rating and work on my career and my family.
So how do you start working on yourself after that trial? What was your first step to working on you?
So I actually learned about your podcast. My nephew finally convinced me to download TikTok sometime last year. And I kept hearing him talk about it. My brother-in-law had it. I'm like, you know what? I'll check it out. Guys at work, the younger guys, all talk about it. So I finally downloaded it, was scrolling through and came across the things we all carry. There's a couple other fire department podcasts I listen to. You know, Crew First Culture is a big one I listen to. And then, what is the other one? It used to be Fit to Fight Fire, but I think it's the standard now.
Mm-hmm.
I listened to them and then I came across yours. And the other ones had touched on mental health a little bit, but once I started listening to your podcast and realizing that, you know, there's a lot of guys out here spilling the beans and just absolutely exposing themselves and their struggles, I started to think about it. I knew I needed help, but being stubborn, I didn't want to take that first step. And then probably, I think it was December 27th or December 28th. It was the night before a shift. I was sleeping and my youngest son came into my bedroom and I was having a nightmare. I don't remember now if it was about the trial or about calls in the past or what, but I was having a nightmare and my son crawled up in bed. And when he grabbed my leg, I panicked and I reached out and grabbed his arms and started yanking him towards me kind of violently. And I woke up to the sound of my son screeching, "Stop, Dad, you're hurting me." And that broke my heart. Now, I didn't physically harm him. He was fine. He wound up cuddling up in bed with us and, you know, the rest of the night was uneventful, but I woke up that next morning and that's all I could think about. And I finally reached out to a friend of mine who is a nurse at the hospital, told her what happened, and she gave me a contact info for a CISM team that mm-hmm. we've utilized at the fire department before. And I reached out to the coordinator of it and just said, "Dude, I need help. I gotta find help." I reached out also to Firefighter Behavioral Health Alliance.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you ever heard of them. Reached out to him to see if he had any contacts in our area. You know, after my friend's suicide, he got really close with their family or his family. And I knew he was a resource. He couldn't find anyone local for me. It would all be telehealth, but the Northwest Ohio CISM team reached back out within 2 hours and said, I have a counselor 20 minutes from you. She is a part of Tri-County Mental Health Association, and she has dove into the first responder world, and it's all free of charge. They have a grant. You can go to her as much as you need. You don't have to worry about insurance. You don't have to worry about anything. Here's her information. Reach out, see what you think. If you don't like it, get a hold of me. I'll get you in contact with someone else. And yeah, it was about a week went by. I made that phone call. He had already passed along my information, so she was just waiting. And as soon as I called her, I was in 2 days later. And I've been going to her about a month and a half now. And she's got me going to a psychiatrist as well. I'm on medication, and it's doing wonders. I mean, I finally start to feel like myself again. I start to feel like I have more control, but yeah, she says it's a long road, and I waited in true firefighter fashion. I waited till the absolute breaking point to get that help. So there's a lot to unbox. But she's wonderful. I mean, you can tell she has done her homework on us. She knows the first responders. And then my fire chief also is requiring mental health evaluations or mental wellness checks for our annual physical. And it's actually the same counselor's office that I was put in contact with. So
what's entailed in these mental health checkups?
So as a standard with everybody in the fire department, you know, we go down for a 1 hour session. I didn't have to do it this year because I'm currently a patient of her, but, everyone goes down, we go in groups of three, and then one at a time you go in and meet with, I think she has three or four counselors who are all, dove into the first responder world, and they just meet with them. You can talk for 5 minutes, you can talk for an hour. And if you want to continue getting that help, you know, you can, no questions asked, no charge. So it's, our chief's putting the forefront of mental health wellness. And, you know, once I cued him on everything going on with me, then, you know, he offered the employee assistance, but I turned it down right away. Just like what we talked about before, I wanted no use with the employee assistance. I wanted someone who knows us, who understands, and she's extremely comfortable to talk to. She doesn't write anything down. She's engaged with you the entire time. And we're actually, she talked about EMDR a little bit, but she just went through the ART training as well. And we're going to dive into that coming up in our next couple of sessions.
What exactly is ART?
I knew you were going to ask. I got to look it up.
I can Google as well if it is.
The same principle as, no, she actually sent me all the information.
Oh, I got you.
I just got to find so many. Got so many spam emails every day. Vicky Chap, there we go. So ART is, if my Wi-Fi will cooperate, accelerated resolution therapy. So it's the same principle as, the way she describes it to me, it's the same principle as EMDR, but they're seeing results in as little as two to three sessions instead of, you know, the five or six sessions with EMDR.
Okay. Let's see, I don't know much about it. So it's something I'm going to have to kind of search and learn about, cause I've never heard of it. So I'm a little caught off guard.
I got this, the one page document she sent me. Okay.
Gives me something to learn. I like it though. So, all right. So you're brand new to therapy.
Oh yeah. Like I said, I spoke with my base mental health counselor for off and on for a couple years. I knew who she was. I knew her background, but, you know, towards leading up to this trial, you know, her and I got really close and, you know, she was calling me, she was calling my wife, just checking in on us. And, it was kind of funny. She told me about 2 months before trial. She's like, man, you need help. You need more than I can provide you. I need you in therapy, you know, for the long haul.
Right.
So I asked her, you know, do I start now? And she kind of hem-hawed a little bit. She's like, I don't think now is a good time. She's like, I want to get you through trial. And after trial, we need to do it. No matter what happens, you have to do it.
Right.
But she's like, I'm afraid if we start therapy before trial, that it's going to lower your defenses and you're not going to be mentally fit to battle in trial. So that's why her and I became basically best friends. You know, she's calling me, she's texting me weekly, biweekly, checking in, making sure I'm doing okay.
Right.
She's reaching out to friends that she knows I'm talking to just to make sure they're not getting any weird vibes from me. And, yeah, then once trial was over, I started to blow off again. And then after that night with my youngest son, I was like, this is it. I can't do this alone.
You're fresh into it. So where do you think you are today? What's different for you? How are you handling things differently today?
So today I'm starting to realize a lot of my self-talk. You know, I am literally my own worst enemy. I don't see myself, like I said about those letters before, I don't see myself the way everyone else sees me. You know, I see myself as a failure. I see myself as a failure is the biggest word. And, you know, terrible father, terrible husband. And through counseling, she has gotten me to realize that a lot and realize a lot of my nightmares that I was having, whether it's about a call, about trial, or about random shit, you know, my self-talk was coming out in that. You know, I would have dreams about the 16-year-old that died. And in that dream, as I'm trying to intubate her in the car upside down, she wakes up. She tells me I'm a failure. She yells, save me, and then goes back unconscious. And that,
Jesus,
talking with my counselor, you know, she's like, that's your subconscious talking to you about yourself.
Hmm.
So being able to realize that, and, you know, I carry around a little like pocket book with me, pocket notebook. And I write that down. Anytime I start to notice that, I write that down. And, she's having me, if I can't sleep, we tried, you know, writing down what my thoughts are racing about, what I'm having trouble letting go of for the day. And then I would go through that list and it's something completely off the wall, like I had no control over, you know, bills piling up, work being stressful. If I can't control it, I need to cross it off that list. That was hard the first couple times. The first two or three times I did it, I couldn't cross shit off the list because her next goal was for me to, you know, start to, the ones I keep, I need to write a brief note of how I'm going to change it, how I'm going to fix it.
Mm-hmm.
And I wouldn't let go of anything. I would try and problem solve everything.
Hmm.
And that would keep me up till 2-3 o'clock in the morning. Getting a little better with it, but yeah, just one day at a time.
How's family life now, today?
Today, eons better than it was. So it was rough going through that whole process. You know, my wife and I grew apart inadvertently, not because of the allegation, but because of me shutting down.
Mm-hmm.
It was my son's birthday last year, his 6th birthday. We were taking him to the zoo. We had about an hour and a half drive and I could tell something was wrong, but I couldn't get it out of her. And I didn't have any idea of what could be wrong, but you know, the kids were content in the back. They're playing on their tablets, they're coloring. So I told her, I said, now's the time. Let's talk about it. I want to know what you're feeling. So it was a knife to the heart when she told me that she feels like we're growing apart, that we're just roommates with kids. You know, we're not interacting with each other. Our intimacy level dropped. We go through the motions. We take care of the kids. We put them to bed. We go our separate ways. She crochets a lot. So she would go crochet. I would read a book or just watch TV, and then we'd both go to bed. I had no idea. I never saw it. So we implemented kind of checks and balances with ourselves. So we started working on it. We got back to being a couple and being supportive for each other. I acknowledge that she's going through a living hell just like I am.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, we're here for each other. So we became very supportive. And through the whole trial, you know, we were there for each other. Whether it's turning around and just giving each other smiles in the courtroom, giving each other hugs at set break sessions, you know, not letting the person causing this to see that it's affected us, that we are stronger than this. And it, my wife and I grew tremendously in not only our relationship, not only in our family, but in our faith. You know, we leaned heavily on our faith. And, you know, today it's eons better. She's my counselor, actually is 100% okay if my wife attends sessions with us. She's attended one so far, and there's plans for her to attend more. That way we can talk about the process together. Her big concern with me going to therapy was, you know, is it safe for him to open all this? Is it safe for him to relive this, to constantly have this on his mind while going through therapy? And, you know, my counselor assured her that it's done in a controlled environment, and that talking about it more and more is to help me move past it. Like I told you when we met before, like I even asked basically permission to come on this show. Like I didn't want this to be something that could be negative for me. And she was having me journal, and she said, this is absolutely great. You know, get out there. The more you talk about it, the more you're going to be able to accept everything that happened and move past it. So Right. It's my family life, my work life, everything is just improved, and it's improving day by day. So I hit it, everything from my crew. I hit everything from my department. They all know now. And again, my fear was isolation and abandon. Just, you know, I can't see myself doing anything else. I have such a passion for this job and the people I work with that I couldn't imagine losing that. And, you know, my department has stepped behind me 100%. My city has stepped behind me 100%. And I have just the amount of support I have from everybody has helped me get through this and has helped me get to where I am today, to realize I need help and realize it's okay to not be okay. It's okay to hurt. It's okay to fear. But I actually wrote down in my phone, I wrote a note about everything that happened in the day I attempted to take my own life. And at the end of that, I said, you know, I don't know why I'm writing this. I don't know what made me decide to put this down, but in hopes that someone hears this story and realizes it's okay to hurt. You know, it's okay to be scared. It's okay to, you know, want to fight. But the one thing that's okay, and the one thing I will teach my kids, is that it's never okay to give up. And, you know, I will never be in that position again where I want to give up on life. And the second incident I had where I was getting close, I drove to my captain's house. You know, he was my longest captain. I was on his ship for the longest before it bounced around. And, you know, I had a problem the Tuesday before trial where I was alone and I was dark and I saw exactly what road I was on. I texted him to see if he was home. He said he was. I drove to his house and immediately surrendered my pistol. And he didn't let me leave the house until I was safe, till I had someone that was going to be with me all day. And it's okay. It's okay to not be okay. That's the big thing.
Yeah. And it's okay to ask for that help.
Yeah.
It's a weird transition.
Yeah. Through this process.
Go ahead. Through this process.
Oh, go ahead.
Nope.
No, I was going to say it's amazing to see that as I opened up to coworkers that, you know, I found out that guys I work with are struggling. You know, they shared their story with me and they were in awe. We were both in awe. You know, none of us knew the other was struggling. And my crew started to see it because I was isolating. I wasn't involved in shift activities, but they didn't know how bad it was. Just like I didn't know how bad their situations were. And, you know, I think that grew us closer together as a crew and, you know, being promoted now, that gives me, I feel a lot more buy-in from my crew that I can be honest with them. Hey guys, I'm fucked up. You know, I'm going to therapy. I'm on medications for this. You know, I'm going to see a psychologist because, you know, I'm at such a point in my life, I can't do it with just therapy. And, you know, it went both sides. It made me value my crew even more. It made them value me more, I think.
Yeah, you become real.
Yeah, the human.
Yeah, and that's some people that are in leadership positions don't believe that that's what they should be, but that's exactly what they should be, is real and human. And I had a talk with a couple of former guests this week, and then I kind of covered it in my intro in the show that released this morning, that that's what we are. We're just human. We're not perfect. Yeah, we've made changes in our lives and we're trying to get better, but that path isn't linear, and we're flawed people. We're flawed individuals, and we're going to make mistakes still. And we're still, even though we're on a path to taking care of ourselves, we still make mistakes, and it's okay to own those mistakes and talk about them.
Exactly.
So I was going to say earlier, it's always awkward to make the transition away from the story to the last two questions. And so I really don't know a better way to do it than, okay, you ready for my last two questions? My last two questions have changed a little bit. I used to ask about an everyday carry and I've kind of gone away from that. And I might still do it once in a while, but I think I know what it is right now for you. And it sounds like it might be the notebook that you're to carry around to jot some things down, if I'm not mistaken. So I like to now ask, when's the last time you felt a sense of awe?
Last time I felt a sense of awe, right around Christmas time.
Okay.
It's gonna directly relate with my kids. My oldest, every year at church, we do a giving tree, and it's to help families in need at the church to help them with Christmas. And there is a girl in his grade that he is very fond of. We'll put it that way. It's not a girlfriend.
Okay.
He's very adamant about that.
Okay.
Girls still have cooties for him, but, he was picking names off the giving tree. Yeah. He was picking names off the giving tree, and he picked one that was eye level, and it was a boy. And, you know, he kind of scanned the tree and saw towards the top, the name Scarlet on a tag. You know, they don't put last names on it, but he saw the name Scarlet and asked my wife to pull it down. And asked how old she was. And it was the same age as the girl in his class. And, you know, he straight up asked my wife, because her little backstory, Scarlett's family, she just lost her father to cancer. Mm. So they were struggling over the holidays.
Yeah.
And he asked my wife to put the first tag that he picked back, because he really wanted to get that tag. And, you know, I razzed him a little bit about it. You know, you picked your girlfriend's tag and all that. He blushed, but I asked him a serious question. I said, Theodore, you know, why did you want that tag so bad? And he looked at me with the most genuine smile and the most amount of innocence you can possibly have and say, Dad, Scarlett is my really good friend and I really want her to have a good Christmas. And that kid picked everything on that list himself. He picked out outfit, picked out her toys, and, you know, we told him he can't tell her he sees her wearing that outfit at school, but
right.
I went in for Valentine's Day as the prevention officer and passed out Valentine's, and she was wearing it. And he came up and pulled me down and whispered in my ear. He said, "Dad, she's wearing what I bought her, and that makes me happy." And just the amount of innocence and compassion that child has just warms my heart.
Yeah, good on Theodore. That's a good start to life.
Yes.
And that speaks volumes to about you and your wife as well. So well done. All right. What about a book? What have you reading lately? What have you read in the past that you might want to recommend? Wherever you want to go with it, you tell me.
A couple different books, actually. Can't Hurt Me by David Goggins.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a wonderful book. And it got me into the crazy mindset of running. I used to hate running in high school. I ran cross country and track, thought it was dumb,
mm-hmm.
but I'm in my 30s now and I'm gearing up for my fourth marathon.
Right.
And then another one, Raising Men. And Eric's something. I'll have to look his name up real quick. My internet is terrible on my phone today. Raising Men is another one, and then An Unfair Advantage by Chad Robichaud.
Okay.
Those are my top three hands down books.
And Raising Men, is it lessons Navy SEALs learn from their training, or is it not boys shepherding your, okay. So it's the first one, lessons from Navy SEALs.
Yeah. It's Eric,
Davis,
Eric something, I believe is the author. Eric Davis.
Yeah, yes. It's by Dina Santarelli and Eric Davis.
Yep, I read that one while I was deployed, expecting my second son. And yeah, that's just an incredible book. And then An Unfair Advantage by Chad Robichaud. Yeah, he was Marine Force Recon, MMA fighter. And, you know, that book, he spills his entire life. Infidelity, battling drugs and alcohol, and then completely turned his life around. And now as a big proponent for veteran PTSD and, you know, saving our allies, him and Kennedy run Save Our Allies. Yeah. You know, just an incredible story.
What, and Save Our Allies was the what they run?
Save Our Allies is, yeah. Save Our Allies is what they run. So they did a lot with the Afghanistan withdrawal, getting interpreters and visa holding Americans out. You know, their organization did an amazing job getting them out. And then same thing in Israel. They've been boots on the ground in Israel and Ukraine, doing as much work as they can to offer any kind of aid they can as a non-government entity or an NGO. Gotcha.
Cool. I'm going to study up about them. Thanks for that. I appreciate that.
Yeah.
Hey, I don't know if you have anything else to add, but I think that was a great conversation. I mean, we got quite the story to tell. And, yeah, and
appreciate
I look,
you having me on.
I look forward to hearing how the journey goes for you, how the recovery and the healing, you know, continues on from this point. So stay in touch.
Will do, man.
Yeah, you got my number and you know where to find me. So don't be bashful.
Yep.
All right, man.
All right.
Go enjoy the rest of your day. I appreciate it.
Hey, thank you. Have a good day.
Thanks for listening to another episode of The Things We All Carry. Head over to the website, thethingsweallcarry.com, for show notes, resources, and to sign up for the newsletter. Until next week, take care of yourselves and remember to check in on each other.